Welcome to episode 30 of Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and every week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. We talk about what motivated them to engage in climate change mitigation, what they do to help, and what their vision for the future is. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. On episode 30, my guest is Jamie Fine, senior economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, or EDF. Jamie recently took a sabbatical from EDF and worked with a startup called OhmConnect. We discussed his work there and his work with the city of Huron, California, and had some very intense discussions about how to move the climate change mitigation ball forward, taking on topics from business models to RPS, or renewable portfolio standards. Jeremy, do you have thoughts about renewable portfolio standards, or RPS?
Look, you need to be able to do your portfolio over and over again. Now, when you do your portfolio over again, because you want to meet the standards, that's up to your standards, that represents you the way you want to be represented, you have to do it a lot of times. That means you have to take pictures, you have to do things. Take pictures, it takes cameras or phones, and you have to charge them, and that's taking a lot of power. It's taking a lot of energy to start doing that. So everybody being so obsessed and so with their portfolio to meet the standards is wasting a lot of energy. So what we need to do is we need to hook up to some kind of solar source, some kind of alternative energy to do that. So that this way we will be able to meet our standards without using up so much energy.
Jeremy, that was not even close. Jeremy is the younger of my two younger brothers, both who, like me, perform comedy improv. Jeremy does it at Comedy Sports Sacramento. He and his wife, Jocelyn, are co-authors of a memoir about each of their experiences 10 years ago when Jocelyn needed a life-saving heart transplant. Spoiler alert, since then, she wrote the book and ran two half marathons. If you are interested in purchasing the memoir, search for Krivat on Amazon. It's called In Sickness and in Health. You might also see my wife's gourmet cat mystery novels and my daughter's volumes of short stories, Tales of Mundane Magic. They are all awesome. Renewable portfolio standards, or RPS, require that a specified percentage of the electricity that an energy supply company sells comes from renewable resources such as wind, solar, biomass, and geothermal. Different states and countries have created these standards to diversify their energy resources, promote domestic energy production, and encourage economic development. Renewable portfolio standards often establish incremental targets, which increase over time. More than half of the U.S. states have some type of renewable energy standard or goal in place. Other names for the same concept include renewable electricity standard at the United States federal level and renewable obligation in the U.K. The targets, compliance mechanisms, and qualifying resources can vary widely between states and countries. I really appreciated Jamie's strong focus on energy equity, wanting to ensure that the most vulnerable and burdened people and communities share in the contribution and benefits of climate change mitigation efforts. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm here in San Francisco with a view of the bay. It's awesome. With Jamie Fine, senior economist for the Environmental Defense Fund, that's EDF. Jamie, welcome to Climate Champions.
Good morning. It's terrific to be here with you.
You told me you listened to a bunch of these, so you know how it's done. Can you talk about your motivating moment? What made you say, I'm going to do something about climate change?
Sure. Well, for me, the motivating moment was really about doing something about the environment, and it wasn't climate change that I went after at the start. And I actually spent some time soul searching when I was in grad school. What is it about environmental work that inspires me? And I realized it's really kind of bookended from two types of experiences growing up as a child. One experience was growing up in a small, relatively pristine community in Ohio, where I would go down to the end of the block in my town and play in a 1,000-acre nature preserve every afternoon.
Wow, that's exciting.
I was very lucky to be able to do that. And looking back on it, I wasn't really particularly good about staying on the trails. And frankly feeling sick the entire time I was there due to smells and sounds and pollution writ
large. You know, I was born and grew up in Brooklyn.
I knew there was a reason we got along well. So you and my mother, I think, maybe went to the same high school. I think we've talked about that. As a kid, didn't understand how and why people lived in cities and survived in cities, and I really found my own cathedrals in the tall trees and the forests. And that was kind of a jumping off point for my professional career after college, where I actually went to the Wharton School of Business undergrad thinking I'd be heading off to be a financier on Wall Street, and pretty quickly realized that was not a very motivating or inspirational pursuit. The idea of trading paper all your life so that someday you could trade it for a big house and a big Mercedes really, really wasn't what I was going after.
Yeah, you're describing my life. So.
And so ultimately I had to ask, what do I feel passionate about? And clearly it was the environment. And so I kind of loaded up the Toyota and moved to the West Coast and wanted to get involved in some kind of environmental work, and discovered quickly that my undergraduate degree in economics was useful in the context of natural resource management. And so my aha moment around climate evolved slowly over time. Like many people, I was attracted to the photogenic megafauna, right? Save the panda bear, save the redwood trees. And frankly, wasn't particularly interested in saving the humans until I started working on this for a while and realized that we're not going to save the rest of them unless we can save the humans at the same time. Over time, climate change became kind of the fundamental organizing issue, right? Although what attracted me to environmental advocacy honestly wasn't even air quality at the outset, right? It's not a particularly sexy topic, but I came to learn over time that my skill set could be applied very effectively to issues of air quality and environmental and social justice, and that's what I ended up coming to EDF to do.
Why is this personally important to you?
Yeah. First of all, you know, my own childhood, my own experience, what gives me happiness and peace. And then things really started to change when I became a father.
Yes.
And at the same time I was becoming a father, I was actually working with the Bay Area Air Quality Management District in their community air risk evaluation study, where they were actually looking at the accumulation of air toxics, cancer risk in the air. And I saw plumes located over the house where I was raising my children, and they were growing their young lungs. Jumping forward a couple of years, my family and I would go up to family camps in the mountains in California. Well, about 3 years ago, our family camp burnt down. And so these experiences of looking at my own children and seeing they're breathing air that's not healthy, connecting that to energy, a lot of that is related to diesel combustion. And my hope was that with California's climate regime that we could actually start getting diesel out of the atmosphere. Again, I kind of approached air quality secondarily, and then only as a third step thought about the context of climate change as the goal here. So it became very personal very quickly, and that changed the passion that I brought to the table. And I actually had to be careful with that, right? Because too much passion, particularly when you're representing EDF views, can be destructive when you're trying to collaborate and find common ground. But it did become very personal to me. And it is still, when I see a colleague working on this, I make a point to thank them, and not just thank them for the work they're doing today for me, but for the future generations. And that's really what motivates me.
Have you had times when your passion got in the way of your work?
Indeed, there have been times, yeah.
Want to talk about a couple of those?
didn't think I'd be lingering on those. once California, and having worked with you, Lee, here in California, in the build-out of digital metering infrastructure, smart meters, AMI, advanced metering infrastructure, my EDF team in New York was trying to push Consolidated Edison to do a similar thing. And they invited me out to provide some perspective and support in those negotiated settings. And what I found very quickly was that the folks sitting on my side of the table in that room didn't have the sense of entitlement that I brought from California as a professional advocate. Across the table was union representatives, and on the other two sides of the table were Consolidated Edison, which went about four or five rows deep, in engineers, and then the regulators on the fourth side of the table. And what I discovered very quickly was that our desire to develop plans and strategies to get to long-term outcomes to protect everyone, including our future generations, were being snickered at by folks on the other side of the table. And I let them have it. I told them if they couldn't be in this room and look past 6 months and be designing outcomes for future generations, that they didn't belong in that room. And what I discovered very quickly was I not only made the folks on the far side of the table uncomfortable, but I made my own team uncomfortable. And that really isn't the way that EDF tries to collaborate, and it's not the way to invite people to a conversation. So it did get in the way, But I also felt a need to set a tone for my own colleagues as well as everyone in the room. But ultimately, I was kind of uninvited from that that setting. And, yes. And over time, I learned that you've got to direct your passion the right way or it can be destructive.
My passion has helped me get a lot of things done. It's also kept me from doing a lot of things.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So when you meet somebody that doesn't believe that there is climate change, how do you explain it to them in a way that they will understand it?
So I've been listening to your podcast, and I've heard a wonderful collection of analogies already. Everything from climate on steroids to probably some analogies that aren't coming to my mind now. So I guess one thing that I've decided is that when I was a younger man, when I thought I knew everything, I would kind of engage in debate on pretty much any topic. And over time, I've learned that I have expertise in certain areas, and there are other areas where I want to defer to others and their expertise. So in the context of climate change, I have some specific expertise, particularly in the energy sector and growing expertise in the transportation sector. And then I bring another lens to the table, which is around social and environmental justice. And I try to bring a perspective to the table that many of the people I'm engaging in over a dinner party or perhaps in the workplace setting don't necessarily have. That perspective is one that can at times be uncomfortable, both for me to represent, but also for those at the table to get their heads around and to embrace. So what I try to do when I talk about climate change is make it real and proximate to people, right? I don't spend a lot of time arguing with people that the science is set because I believe that it is. And those who aren't willing to accept that science are going to pick and choose the evidence that they're looking for. And I'm not really going to try to change their mind on that. But I do try to provide some perspective. For example, if you're sitting in California in a high-rise in San Francisco, you might not understand what climate change feels like to someone who lives in the Central Valley, which is a very high-energy burden area where it's super hot in the summer and actually quite chilly in the wintertime. And experience with increasing global weirding is a term I like to use, right? The point being that, so you've seen, for example, politicians in Washington hold up snowballs during a blizzard and say global warming must not be real. And I help people understand that, well, the real issue here is global weirding, that our weather is going to get weirder and more extreme. And then usually I try to help people understand that a lot of that just comes from the notion that there's a lot more energy in the atmosphere. And I usually try to not go much further than that in terms of trying to explain the science. But in my experience, people can kind of get their head around both what does it mean to be living in an environment that is increasingly weird, more extremes. If I'm talking to a neighbor, I can point out that we live 10 feet above sea level. If I'm talking to someone who's living in the Central, and I live San Francisco Bay, if I'm talking to someone who lives in the Central Valley, I can point out the issue of extreme weather, right? And I think that people can connect to that. And then also I like to talk with people about their cars because people don't really want to talk energy efficiency. They don't want to talk electrons and electricity, but everyone wants to talk about their cars. And people understand how cars contribute pollution, right? I will also mention that when I started at EDF about 12 years ago, we did some focus group research on what do people in California know and care about climate change and what are they doing or see themselves as doing. And across the board, people saw recycling as the thing they were doing to help address climate change. And in that case, I found at first that I would perhaps judge that a little bit and over time realize that I needed to embrace the small steps that people could take and kind of meet them where they're at. And that's usually how I try to engage on climate change.
I am starting to get asked by people what they can do beyond recycling.
Yeah.
What more can they do? And that's exciting that people want to do something about it now.
Absolutely. Particularly in the context of they're getting messaging now that recycling isn't such a good thing, and that's a temporary lull. The market needs to catch up with all this low-cost resource that now China doesn't want to buy from us and put back into their manufacturing. But when people get those kinds of messages, I fear it could be quite destructive for a desire to take action. And indeed, that's also what I find, that people want to be part of the solution, and what they're looking for is ways to do that. And that's where I like to come in and offer suggestions.
Talk about what you do at EDF.
Sure. At EDF, if you don't like the policy weather, it's okay. The weather's going to change soon. And what I mean by that is, as an organization, we try to be innovative and at the tip of the spear And that tip of that spear looks different if you're on the West Coast than if you're on the North, in the Northeast, or if you're, for example, in Puerto Rico or China, all places where EDF is working. I sit in California, so that means I have my eyes on the tip of the California energy spear, which is quite sharp and quite ahead of many, many places around the country and some places around the world. And I also have vision on California's cap and trade program, our to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. So I bring all of that perspective to the table and help other jurisdictions understand what California is doing, which of those ideas and lessons can we adapt, for example, for a New Jersey clean energy initiative, or can we bring to a national effort. Very specifically, over the last 6 months, as you know, I've been on sabbatical visiting a residential virtual power plant network company called OhmConnect. There I was really asking the question, how does the OhmConnect service, which is simply engaging people in reducing their electricity use for 1 hour a couple times a week in the evenings. An important hour in the evenings when the natural gas power plants are ramping up to provide generation resources as the sun is, solar resources are going offline.
Duck curve.
The duck curve.
I have once had it as a learner term.
Okay. Yeah.
My brother defined it as a line of ducks starting to curve because of climate change.
That's problematic. So a lot of what I do now is working on both the belly and the head of the duck in California, but also helping other jurisdictions understand just what is the opportunity and challenge that California's regime presents. So I had some visitors from China, for example, and they're, you know, putting a lot of investment into solar. They apparently haven't thought yet about what does that mean for when the sun's setting and how do they serve power in the evening, the so-called head of the duck, when we increasingly expect people to be coming home and plugging in their EVs and turning on their air conditioning. So a lot of what I'm doing, and I'll just cut to the more specifically, is I'm trying to get us to our clean energy and our climate change goals at least cost. And that last part is the part that we often forget, right? So I operate in a variety of settings. For example, the Marin County drawdown effort, in an effort to draw down Marin County's greenhouse gas pollution. I'm in that setting helping them see solutions like what OhmConnect can bring to the table, which is a zero-cost solution and a stepping stone or a start. But I'm also in the room to help them recognize that you don't have a blank check, and we need to be very thoughtful about the economics of this. And what I often will say is what I'm trying to do is put in place policy and practices and incentives for industry actors to empower households and small businesses to be the battery. And what I mean by that is this duck curve problem plainly means that nowadays we're turning off a lot of solar generation in the middle of the day here in California, massive quantities of so-called curtailment of solar generation. What many people see as the solution is batteries, right? A strategy for storing that generation so that we could use it in the evening once the sun sets. Well, we can do that by buying a bunch of Tesla and other types of large batteries and plugging them into the utility side of the grid. And the utility shareholders will be excited about that because they will get a return on that investment for that asset. The alternative, and I would say the parallel companion strategy, because it's not either or, hopefully it's yes and, is to empower energy users and their appliances and their buildings to store up that energy, to use it in the middle of the day when the solar is generating, but also to store it, for example, in the form of very cool houses or ice in refrigerators and freezers, and then use that storage capacity in the evening rather than having to use natural gas power plants or having to buy a utility scale battery pack. So that utility scale battery pack is going to be a key part of the solution, as I say, but if we just do it with that solution, it's going to be very expensive, and we're not actually legitimately empowering people to get the services they need at least cost and to be part of the solution. So that's a lot of what I work on in EDF. There's more that the EDF Energy Program works on around how do we get our utilities excited about evolving past their gas infrastructure from a business model perspective. How do we get and achieve electrification of medium and heavy duty vehicles, a space that with EDF thinks there's a need for some additional push. It's a potpourri of work, but it probably doesn't sound like I'm as focused as I actually am.
Well, since you're an economist, here's something I've noticed. A lot of people will talk about the cost to go 100% renewables, but we don't know the cost because the technology is going to change before we get to 100%.
Yeah.
And the cost to get to 60 or 70% is substantially less because you don't need all that storage that you just talked about.
Yeah. Well, and there's increasing arguments. Some will say, you actually don't need a lot of storage. You just need to solarize the heck out of it, right? Lots and lots of solar. It's the least cost solution. So there's a variety of competing modeling studies of the future out there, right? And I think what we need to do is look back a little bit for lessons for the future. So in California, we've been doing integrated resource planning. And this is something we've done for decades in California and elsewhere. Traditionally, it has been towards the goal of keeping the lights on, so-called maintaining reliability at least cost, right? But in the last couple of years in California and elsewhere, we've been doing this planning with the goal of getting to our clean energy goals and getting our greenhouse gas reductions to sustainable levels. When we pursue integrated resource planning in that way, what you see is a wonderful political economy of California, so that everyone comes to the table with their preferred solution. If you are a municipality, you want to see endogenous renewable energy generation, and you want to see perhaps communities being the battery. If you are a solar developer, you want to see large-scale transmission investments so you can bring lots of solar generation from the deserts in Nevada. If you have a lot of geothermal resource in Southern California, you want to see that to be the core solution to our getting to our green. And the answer, again, is a lot of yes and, right? And of course, if you're other advocates, you want to see more energy efficiency investments and other types of community-scale renewables. So everyone's got their solution. As you say, the economics do ultimately drive the picture. During that integrated resource planning debate that we had last year, many said, hey, we should go and buy a lot more solar so we could take advantage of the federal tax credits, which might go away. But if you look back 5 years, what you'll see is the cost of solar dropped 80% over that five-year period. So if we jumped to procure a whole bunch of solar 5 years ago,
it's more expensive.
We would have
solar.
Even with the 50% reduction or even the 30% reduction from the federal tax credit, it would have been more expensive than waiting,
and
right?
Some of that 30% tax credit causes a lot more complication in the capital stack, which
indeed
eats up a lot of that money.
Indeed, and leads perhaps for us to throw a lot of additional investment at capacity that we don't optimize. So there was a study by Lawrence Berkeley Labs that asked, by 2025, what is it going to look like as we pursue our renewables goals, as we build new renewable capacity? And they estimated that 12% of our renewable generation capacity would be dumped, not utilized, unless we can inspire energy users to shift some of their demand to better lined up with solar generation. And if we could do that, if we can inspire just 20% of demand in 2025 to line up better with solar, we increase the capacity utilization of our renewables from 88% up to 98%, saving Californians on the order of $500 million a year.
When I was at SDG&E, the EV group met with the rates group, and we actually did a day-ahead hourly rate that was least expensive during duck curve days when there was a lot of solar, when the sun was in the sky, so noon to two. And we put a lot of chargers in at work so that we could charge cars when the sun was out. And I think that's the type of thing that needs to be done.
Absolutely. As you know, I'm a big fan of that strategy, right? I've advocated for a long time, not just V1G, putting that power in our vehicles and storing it up, but as well, let's again think about empowering the consumer to be the battery. So you're at SDG&E and you've got your EV charged up because it was sitting there in that lot charging all day, but you're an SDG&E employee, so you're working hard and you're working late into the evening, right? Or maybe not.
Never.
but now you have the choice. Well, I could leave my office at 5 o'clock and go sit in traffic in my EV and maybe not feel so bad about it because it's an EV. Or I could work an extra 2 hours and allow my EV to provide some V2G energy back into the grid and let my car buy me dinner. And then I'll go home after the traffic, and the car has now been part of the virtual power plant solution. That's an example of the type of solutions I'd like to see in the system that we're not seeing yet, right? And so I see my job, I don't want to say a futurist, but trying to continue to remind policymakers and commercial actors that these kinds of solutions need to be continued, we need to continue to pursue them if we're going to empower customers and get those least cost solutions that are also equitable in terms of putting the equity where we really want to see it. You're trying to get your head around your car buying you dinner, right? The simple notion is your car can allow some of the energy to come off the battery for a price, and then you drive home. You're not tapping your battery to zero. You still got plenty of mileage. And I know that you and I have maybe different views on this. But it's also what I mentioned earlier. I talk with people about their cars because they can get their head around it, right? And that, I mean, maybe it's not your car doing it. Maybe it's your refrigerator doing it, right? Or your whole house doing it.
I don't know what different view you think I have. These are the views I've been talking about for almost 10 years now.
Great, great.
I did go on an all-home day-ahead hourly rate that varied from 9 cents to $1.50 per kilowatt hour while I was on it. And when it was 100 degrees out, and I told my wife it's $1.50 per kilowatt hour, so we can't put the AC on, she said, sorry, you are wrong. If she had talked to you, she would have said, we are not going to be a virtual battery tonight, dear.
Yeah, I hear you. And you know, and but the point there is that you could make a decision for a price, right? And you actually are empowered to
do that. I'm with you. I am totally with you.
But the other element of this, though, is, and again, how I try to engage folks on climate change is, well, what if you sat in the Central Valley and you don't have an EV, but you want one, and you don't have a house that can be a battery because it's too leaky, and you don't have internet connectivity, although you'd like it. How do we think about getting those households opportunities first? In my view, if we can't get our most vulnerable, most burdened households the services they need first, we're not going to get to California to our 2050 goals. And so that's really kind of the backdrop that I bring to the table every day when I work at EDF. If we can back off staring at our individual problem, we can find better solutions. So let me give you a detailed example. One thing you asked me early on is, what do I work on? And for 5 years at EDF here in California, I've worked on transitioning residential electricity prices from our tiered rate structure to a time of use structure, as you put it earlier, to try to signal to customers that, hey, electricity is both clean and cheap right now in the middle of the day because it's coming from the sun, so we're going to price it as such. I thought that would be an opportunity for households to simply pre-cool their homes. So when they get home in the evening, they don't have to have the conversation you had with your wife because the house is already cool. And prices, they might be $1.50 per kilowatt hour, but you've already cooled your house, right? You've used your air conditioning in the middle of the day and you've powered your house with sun. I had the opportunity to measure 104 homes, every room of every home, every 4 minutes for 2 weeks in Huron, California, a small agricultural city. I think it's actually considered one of the top, one of the five poorest cities in California. It's a city 45 minutes south of Fresno, deep in the heart of the Central Valley. It's about 9,000 people, 97% Spanish-speaking, and most of these people work in the agricultural industry. When we measured these 104 homes, let me ask you, Lee, of those 104 homes, how many of them do you think could economically pre-cool their homes in advance of an evening peaking price for a time of use rates? That is, how many of them could be winners by running their air conditioning units, say, from 2 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, turning off the air conditioning and allowing their house to stay cool, hopefully, till 8 o'clock at night? How many of the 104 homes that we measured?
I'm going to fairly confidently say zero.
You got it.
Because I think my house, which I've tried to design to be efficient, I don't think the cooling on a hot day would last into when we got home from 4 o'clock.
Yeah, and your house is probably pretty efficient, pretty well built.
But by the time I got home, because I'm working 2 extra hours so my car can buy me dinner, by the time I get home, it's hot again.
You're right that 104 out of 104 homes that we measured in Huron are too leaky to effectively pre-cool. But it's even worse than that, Lee. One out of three of those homes, one in three, had no active cooling. These are homes in the middle of the desert, where people are coming off of the tomato and onion fields at 5 o'clock at night with core body temperatures probably at fever levels. And they're going into homes that, if they're lucky, have a swamp cooler and a fan.
And it's only going to get worse.
And it's only getting hotter, right? And even worse than that, many of those agricultural jobs are going away in Huron. You know why? Because those farms across the street from town are being converted to solar farms, which are being turned off in the middle of the day. And meanwhile, the community across the street can't get the cooling service it needs. So on the one hand, that's a terribly defeating observation. As an economist, on the other hand, though, I see massive inefficiency and opportunity. There's an opportunity for those solar panels that are being turned off in the middle of the day to provide cooling service for the community across the street. But we need to take some bigger steps as well. We need to do something to make those houses healthier. And so when I suggest there's more opportunity, I suggest that now our health agencies and our public services agencies writ large, not necessarily our energy and climate agencies in California, are also trying to invest in the same community. And if we can coordinate and operate at a community scale at the same time we look at the individual household scale, I think we can see more value and more opportunity. And so this idea of empowering a household to be the battery or a car to be the battery to store up solar, think about a community working in a coordinated fashion to do that. And now we have a new opportunity. And this is actually something I got vision on when I was at Ohm Connect for 6 months. Ohm Connect enrolls individual households in their behavioral program to save energy, electricity for 1 hour in the evening, but they help households be successful by giving them Wi-Fi devices, a simple device that goes into the plug that Ohm Connect can turn on and off remotely, or Wi-Fi enabled thermostats like a Nest that, again, Ohm Connect can turn on and off. And households voluntarily participate in these programs. And what we suggest at Ohm Connect is plug those devices into your refrigerator so that we can turn your refrigerator off for an hour. And you're a winner in our program, whether or not you're even home. And you're starting to now chip away at energy costs. You're starting to connect households. And these devices can be provided at zero net cost because people are reducing their energy use, reducing their bills, and getting paid by Ohm Connect. How does Ohm Connect pay them? They aggregate all of that behavior across our tens of thousands of customers and tens of thousands of devices and sell that aggregated resource as a virtual power plant.
And I think it's important to point out that this also helps the energy system as a whole.
Absolutely. That's what they're doing. They're selling that resources to PG&E or SoCal Edison or San Diego Gas and Electric or to community choice aggregators as a resource that helps them meet their reliability needs in the evening as the sun is setting. In August of last year, Ohm Connect delivered a 100 megawatt virtual power plant resource to the California grid. That's a very significant resource.
That is very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to bring it home and provide some scale, you know, there are about 5,000 participants just in the city of Oakland in Ohm Connect, which, by the way, city of Oakland is the most ethnographically diverse city in America. And those approximately 5,000 participants have been paid about $9 million. No, I'm sorry. No,
that's a lot of money.
No, I said that wrong. All of Ohm Connect customers have been paid about $9 to $10 million over the past few years. The Oakland customers have been paid about $120,000. That's $120,000 of payments going into the community, into individuals' pocketbooks, right? That's kind of a transformational kind of relationship. So I'm excited to see that scale.
Can you talk about some challenges that you've had?
Oh, yeah. So one, we mentioned that we already talked a little bit about how if you bring too much passion to the table, it can be a little bit destructive.
You broke my mic with your passion. I think you overloaded it.
So being at EDF, the challenge I came to the table with the very first day was there's a lot of stakeholders whose opinions I care about and value who disagree with what EDF is trying to accomplish. Let's start with climate cap and trade, right? I actually came to EDF thinking that I could help bridge the gap that had grown between environmental justice advocacy groups and the so-called Big Greens, the sponsors of California's climate action plan and its cap and trade program in particular. And that's a challenge that continues to dog EDF, that we have a different modus operandi. Our staff is not as diverse as we'd like it to be, and doesn't always represent the variety of perspectives that we need to have at the table, yet EDF continues to get access to these tables, right? And so that's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity if we stare it in the face and recognize it. And I think EDF's been doing a better job of that over the last half decade or so. Another challenge that I face is finding what is the tip of the spear in California that EDF should be working on in particular, and how that resonates and supports the work we're doing around the country and around the world. And of course, another challenge is that EDF is a donor-based organization, and our funding model is, you know, let's get $101 million grants, not $1 million grants, but still we are, you know, donor-funded, and so oftentimes our ambition exceeds our capacity.
Can you talk about the success you're most proud of?
Oh, well, thanks for asking that. And in fact, thanks for spurring me to think on that question for this podcast. I actually have three notes that I made on what I'm most proud of. So the first is, I did come to EDF to work on cap and trade design. And I wasn't the one who contributed to writing the enabling legislation, but I did help with the actual kind of details of the design. And I have moments of pride where I helped different stakeholders see that they weren't, in fact, disagreeing. They just had different worries, and we could actually find some common ground. But more broadly, I'm excited that we got the cap and trade program designed and implemented. And though it has elements that I'm not particularly happy with, I tend to be a perfectionist when it comes to policy design. It is, I still think, the best cap and trade program in the world, and it's still going. Over the past half decade or so, I've worked on residential rate reform in California. And personal successes as an advocate in this space don't always look like, oh, now we have a new law. Oftentimes it looks like, 2 years ago I was working with a stakeholder who didn't see eye to eye with me, and now I see that stakeholder's advocacy echoing what I was advising. That to me is success. It's a quieter success, but I've basically seen many stakeholders come along to the notion of we need a time of use rate for many residences. And at the same time, I'm proud of, frankly, myself for recognizing that it's not a perfect solution, that there are many vulnerable customers that we're going to need, that are going to need additional help. And that leaves me both worried and a little bit proud that we're trying to solve that problem. Most fundamentally, the biggest success I feel I have is actually when I look across the industry and I look at my colleagues at EDF and I see folks I've mentored and that are now successfully contributing to being part of the solution, at least in little part because of the advice I've given them, the inspiration I've given them, the guidance I've given them. And so I'm increasingly enthusiastic about raising up the next wave of advocates and solutions experts. And that's probably my biggest point of pride, quite frankly.
I remember when you helped the SDG&E smart grid team understand things in different ways. It was very important to us.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And you often, in my work, you don't get that validation. So I do look for them. And then when I find them, I etch them in stone and I put them under my pillow.
I won't get into the fact that one of your colleagues gave us a D or something.
That's another, point of pride is that, that idea of the smart grid report card was mine. I don't know that you liked the grade you got, but I think the idea was a good one, right? And it did help move the industry forward.
Can you talk about your vision of the future?
Well, I think you've heard me use the term yes and, right? There's a lot of my solution versus your solution. And, the reality is the future is going to be a combination, right? It's going to be an agglomeration of these different solutions. And my version of the future is the folks in the Central Valley are getting the service they need. The communities are better coordinated, better connected, healthier. It really knocked me on my heels when I went and looked at the data for Huron, California, and discovered that there isn't a single household in this community that is ready for the future of clean energy in California. But I'm very excited that this community is engaged and we're working with this community to try to identify solutions. And so to me, the really exciting future isn't when the Hurons that are actually have really special advocates within their own community, the mayor, Ray Leon, who also is the executive director of the LEAP Institute, but the communities that aren't engaged like that, the communities that don't have charismatic, enlightened, brilliant leaders, still managed to be a part of the clean energy future because of the policies which we put in place. A lot of the times I'm asking the question, like, for example, the RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard. This is something that California and many other states have used as a jumping off point. As an economist, I was never a fan, quite frankly, right? I was never a fan because I saw it as putting a lot of cost pressure into the system. Well, what we've observed in California and we've observed in Texas and New York is that those renewable portfolio standards have been blown away. Why? Because the economics are driving us towards renewables without some legislative mandate, right? To me, that's a great example of how we're going to get to success at scale, at the speed we need, and in all the communities where we need it. Policies like that, where the economics are properly aligned and the opportunities are there for our most vulnerable communities to be winners. I won't say I have all the answers, but that's the future I'd really like us to see.
I'm going to push you a little bit on this vision question. Let's look 40 years from now, this world that we live in, this earth that we live on, what's it going to look like 40 years from now?
Well, I'm afraid that there's still going to be a lot of haves and a lot of have-nots, and that worries me a lot. I, for example, am looking at work Environmental Defense Fund is doing in Puerto Rico, and we're talking about notions of microgrids, which makes a heck of a lot of sense in a setting where the grid is a kind of a national grid is either beyond reach or not reliable. But I also worry about the haves and the have-nots in the context of a world where people can get their Tesla, get their rooftop solar, island that system if the grid goes down and get all the service they need. But what about the person across the street? Or more accurately, if you don't live in Atherton, California with your rooftop solar and your Tesla, but if instead you look 118 miles due east of Atherton and you arrive in Huron, California, right? Ironically, that's the one-way range of a Tesla, right? 120 miles out, 120 miles back. If you look at Huron, and if you ask, is the solution for Huron everyone's going to own a Tesla and have rooftop solar? You know that's not the answer, right? So we know part of the answer is community-scale solutions, like community-scale solar. But we also know part of the answer is, how do we enhance mobility for people who need mobility? How do we, and clean mobility, right? Well, if you look at Huron, the mayor has built a community mobility services center, and he's got his Green Raiteros program where community members are providing Uber-like services using electric vehicles that are charged up in the community mobility services center. Now, if we start charging those EVs with that solar across the street that's being turned off all day, now this community is getting access to free zero emissions transportation. Those are examples of the kind of solutions that I think we're going to see in the system in 40 years, but we got to set out to deliver them. They're not just going to show up on their own.
Are we going to deliver them?
I hope so. I heard one of your colleagues, I think it was Scott Anders, who said something like he was an optimistic pessimist or something, right? Look, I'm an optimist. You don't do this work if you're a pessimist and you don't think it can be done. Every day, I bring to the table what I call radical confidence. And that radical confidence is simply the notion, and I learned it from an environmental lawyer named Sharon Duggan, who was trying to stop the cutting down of old growth redwood forests. And she said, you try to stop a redwood forest from being cut and you win, and next year the developer's back with a new proposal. And the next year the developer's back with a new, and you have to defeat them every year. And then in year 10, you lose, and that redwood forest gets cut down. Does that mean you stop doing the work you do? No. You stay radically confident that the steps you're taking are the right steps. You don't second guess yourself. You need to be open to doing your work better or to doing your work differently, but you need to be radically confident that the solutions you're pursuing can be accomplished and can be achieved. And if you don't, you probably don't belong in the space. You don't bring that confidence to the table.
Do you have any questions for me?
I do have a couple questions for you, actually.
No.
Yeah. Okay, the easy one first. Have you ever thought about running for public office?
My wife and I have discussed it. She's very involved now. She never was before, but the last couple of years she has been. And based on what she's seeing and seeing just how the sausage is made, she no longer would want me to do that. And she used to want me to do that.
I see. It's interesting that you redirected the decision to your wife, right? Your own. That's okay.
Happy life.
Yeah, I hear you.
And the other way around, it's reciprocal.
That was my soft way of asking / challenging you to say, how do we get to these solutions? Well, we get people like Lee Cravat doing everything they can to get us to the solutions. And so I want to challenge you. You're not done. And there's a lot that you could bring to the table to help. And I know you know that. So, and public office is maybe one version of that. But
I think I'm trying to do that with this podcast. I honestly do. I think my listeners have been growing with each episode. I'm hoping that continues and hopefully get a couple of big bumps one way or another and get a lot of people rowing in the same direction. So the podcast is a big thing. I'm also on boards and advisory boards for a lot of clean energy and clean transportation companies. And I also mentor where I'm not on the board and give them advice. So I'm hoping that if I'm trying to multiply what I know to get the biggest bang for the buck.
Okay, that's terrific. I did want to ask one question about the podcast. And if you are intentional about the diversity of perspectives that get represented on this podcast, you heard my not great answer, I think, around how do you engage people on climate change, and it is the notion of trying to bring a variety of perspectives to that table. And I'm just curious how you've thought about your podcast as a platform for that.
I'm trying to do exactly that. I started out thinking it was going to be CEOs of energy companies, but now I've interviewed environmentalists, I've interviewed professors, I've interviewed politicians, trying to get those different perspectives. Republicans and Democrats, men and women, I want it to be as diverse as possible.
One of the questions I was preparing myself for this podcast was, did you have an aha moment in your work, right? And I thought on that question because I had an aha moment with you, Lee, when we were working on Smart Grid. You might recall we were trying to get environmental performance metrics kind of formalized and on the books. And though you very collegially helped us think through what those metrics might be, ultimately the utility stakeholders in the room wouldn't embrace those and commit to those metrics. And you gave me an aha moment and you said, look, we've already got the money for the smart meters. Offering environmental metrics for the performance of our smart grid regime is kind of sticking our necks out for no reason at this point. And that was a reminder to me that really what's going to drive this to success is the appropriate business models. So I know that you have an eye on a lot of exciting, innovative companies. One of my big questions for you are, where are the opportunities for business model proof points now? EDF is big on business models. We like to talk a game about demonstrating business models, but you know what? We're not in business. We are not an energy business, but we still do want to see or identify and nurture business models that'll get us to scale and solution at speed. I'm curious if you have ideas about where there are key points to press on it.
First, I'm going to comment on the aha moments I gave you. And I firmly believe that you get what you measure. So if you measure making money and that's how you incent, then that you're going to get money making ideas. If you are incenting based on carbon in the atmosphere and that's how you reward, then you're going to get a reduction in carbon. So be careful about that. There's an old story about, probably going to get the details wrong, the English Navy, and they had a rat problem on all the boats. And so they put a metric in place if people and a reward system in place that if a group of sailors came forth with 10 dead rats, they would get a bottle of rum. And so it was incredibly effective. The rat problem was almost completely removed. The sailors were super happy. They had a lot of rum. And then the rum ran out and there were no more rats. So they started breeding rats. So you have to be careful.
Okay. Got to get the incentives right. Absolutely.
So at the risk of getting into a little bit of trouble here, I do think that the utility business model, since you mentioned the utility, they make money by investing capital. You talked about batteries. So of course, they would love to own the batteries because then that's capital they can earn money on. There should be some consideration for some component, maybe a small percentage, maybe a large percentage, being based instead of on how much capital is invested. Some of the profit or a lot of the profit could be tied to reduction in the cost of the system, how sustainable the system is, how renewable the system is, other metrics that are thought carefully through because we don't want people breeding rats.
Right.
But metrics that reward what we really want being the motivator for our utilities instead of the current method, which gets you a lot of iron in the ground, but maybe not in the optimal way for the mission that California and the country is on.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with that. I get a little worried about that gets us incremental movement and maybe not the transformation we need. I also worry about it from the perspective of transformation is not on the horizon. It is upon us here in California. And if you don't believe me, look how much solar we're turning off every day. Yet other elements of California society have not transformed, like people who are energy burdened getting the services they need and being able to afford that. I agree with you. You can't get credit for what you don't want to measure, and you're not going to pursue what you're not going to get rewarded for. I also just, I worry that perhaps the answer is it's not the load-serving entity rate-regulated utility business model I'm interested in. I'm interested in the third-party business models that can quickly transform how the traditional utilities think about doing their business.
Yeah, I was giving you one example. And by the way, I do think the utilities could do amazing things quickly if they were incented to do those amazing things quickly. I'm on the board of a company that's working on a new solar material that could be as much as 90% less than the solar material we get from China.
Wow.
They are very close, but like any startup, they've been closed for a while. Actually, episode number four, Pi Energy, I interviewed the two co-founders. They have incredible ideas for business models once they get their material at the right efficiency level. I'm a technologist at heart. So when the technologies are there, they create new business models. I did interview Jigar Shah, and he really brought the zero down solar model. I think a lot of the solar that's been deployed is thanks to the work that he did initially with SunEdison.
So I agree with you. I would just note that technology includes behavior and knowledge. So, you know, there's a big debate about, for example, when we deregulated the railroad industry and started bringing low sulfur coal from the mountain states to the East Coast coal power plants, and we dramatically reduced sulfur emissions. Was that innovation due to deregulation, simply shipping low sulfur coal across the rail lines? Many would argue that was an innovative step by the coal industry. Others would say that's pretty unimpressive incrementalism. I think empowering customers with knowledge and the technology capabilities, such as well-weatherized homes and internet-connected devices, those are key technologies, but also the technology of the mind and the behavior and the community scale action, I think, is going to be important too.
I can't disagree with you, but I do think that it is very hard to change people. So people tape television shows now, or internet shows now, or streaming entertainment now. When VCRs first came on the market, people couldn't figure out how to use them to tape, even though that's why they were buying them. So I think unless you find ways of making these changes very simple and very in line with what people do want to do, I don't think you're going to get a lot of change.
I'm going to share with you another aha moment that I came to when I was visiting with Ohm Connect over the first half of this year. Having worked on residential rate design for years, and smart grid before that, and climate change policy statewide before that, I frankly had been pretty beaten down by the notion that anyone gave a heck about this stuff, right? And particularly that damning statistic from Accenture that the average electricity user thinks about their energy bill about 20 minutes per year, which is, you know, a couple minutes a month, right, when they're writing the check to pay their bill. And in California, here I am working on in working groups, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on marketing, education, and outreach to California energy users around clean energy and time-variant rates. The notion being, well, what if we really do a great job and we double, nay, we triple people's attention span? Now we've got them not 2 minutes
for an hour?
A month. Now we've got them for 6 minutes a month. Are we getting anywhere, right? Go over to Ohm Connect and look what they're doing with their 500,000 California customers who have signed up with their system and the 110,000 active enrolled customers. Those are folks who have connected their energy bills to Ohm Connect's platform, right? And Ohm Connect is engaging with these folks in a way that I didn't know was possible. That is, people do want to talk and play energy use behavior pattern change, right? They really do want to plug in devices. So I've learned, and I've actually frankly was worried that Ohm Connect was going to face a cultural gap. Ohm Connect is like a lot of really brilliant Stanford engineers. And I'm asking, how could this group of engineers really meet their customers when their best customers are moderate and low-income households in the Central Valley? How could they work together? And what I've discovered is, through gamification, through online interaction with texting and emailing, and with neighbors talking to each other because they've built teams within Ohm Connect, what you do get is much deeper, much more sustained engagement than what Accenture and those in the utility industry have come to accept as gospel. And the other interesting element of this is they're jumping over cultural gaps. And for an example and a proof point of that, I could look at my own son, who sits in my living room playing Fortnite with a maybe a kid, maybe an adult, I don't know, from Czechoslovakia and from Japan and from China. They don't speak any common language other than Fortnite, a video game, right? But Ohm Connect is doing that kind of gamification with energy use and deeply engaging across community in California in a way that I didn't know was possible. So I'm not ready to give up on consumers.
I didn't say to give up. I said people tape their shows today.
Yeah.
It's simple. It's simple to do. And I think making it fun is another check mark. You make it fun, you make it simple, you make it
profitable.
Rewarding.
Rewarding. People getting paid, right.
Rewarding. Yeah. Obviously rewarding financially, and you've got yourself a product. And I didn't say we wouldn't have them, but I think that is what has to be focused on when you're engaging people.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. That simple message of save energy, get paid has been very effective. Though what we've discovered, or you know, Ohm Connect has discovered, is that gets a lot of people involved. The payments aren't significant. And so the reason why the folks, say, who work at the Google campus or the Genentech campus who earn big incomes participate in Ohm Connect is because they're excited to be part of the clean energy solution. They're excited to be part of a group effort. And sometimes they like playing games as part of this effort. And so it isn't just about pay me and I'll play. It's also like, that helps, but that's not the only reason folks are contributing to this effort, right? So, but for a lot of income-strapped households, it's got to start with that. And also, you know, the idea here is you're getting folks access to connectivity into devices and to solutions that otherwise would be out of reach.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I think we've about covered it. I think we've gone long today, right?
Yeah. Okay. Then I'm going to wrap it up with a wrap. You said that you were radically confident and you got into this for the environment. There was a woman. She was Redwood Tree Hugging. I think her name was Sharon Duggan. There's an improv term that I think is really grand, but you have stolen it. It is yes, and you got very nervous. You felt the doom because over your house, you saw a plume. I'm really glad you invited me here to hear about your search for the tip of the spear. You know, there's something you have a lot in common with me. We both really like V to G. I know you're really concerned about the town that could be gone. You spent a lot of focus on here, Ron. You want to make a difference, and I know you can. We've got to focus on the integrated resource plan. You didn't stick to the trails you like to curve when you used to explore near your neighborhood preserve. I'm calling it done. Jamie was a lot of fun to interview. He was super passionate about everything we discussed and moved forward and away from the mic throughout the interview, sometimes making contact with the mic. If you listen close, you might be able to hear some of the head against mic moments, but I try to edit those to a low volume or out completely if I could. He had also listened to a bunch of my previous podcasts and volunteered to beatbox while I rapped. He did a great job, but I just couldn't keep the beat, so I took that out as well. We did a lot of laughing over it. And speaking of laughing, if you are in San Diego and want some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates, and if you want a release from some of life's stress, consider taking an improv class at a workshop in your town. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. Jamie openly discussed how his strong passion sometimes gets in the way of getting things done, but that same passion fuels his radical confidence to drive forward in the face of adversity, which is necessary to mitigate climate change.